Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCAA 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 1050 AM Palm Springs.
Now joining us, like we said earlier, we have author and a journalist. I say that because this last book is just incredible, and it really caught me listening to it. There's a lot of parts that were very real to me. So I found it an excellent book, and we recommend it. And the book is Dead Reckoning, and our author and guest is Caitlin Rother. Thank you for being here.
Well, thank you for having me, and thank you for the kind words on the, how much you enjoyed the book. I appreciate that.
Well, yeah, and it's just kind of, for me, it was listening to the events happening in the childhood, in the era, early era, was really, I felt it. It was really shocking. You know what I mean? It. Mm-hmm. I had a similar childhood myself. So.
Oh wow.
Well, not. But yeah, some people say that. And I was like, well, I'm okay. You know, I turned out okay. I made it through it. I didn't feel like going out and killing anyone. So.
That's what I was going to say, and you didn't go kill anyone, so that's good.
No, we were talking about that before the show, actually, Mike and I, because in a lot of these cases, you know, we look at the childhood and how bad of a childhood they had and maybe what happened to them, and a lot of places want to blame that on why they turn into a killer.
Well, they, yeah. As I discussed in the book, and there's a courtroom scene with a witness, a psychologist who discusses that actually and says it's really a matter of resilience. And so like Skylar DeLeon's sister turned out to be a phlebotomist and never even really had a speeding ticket. Meanwhile, Skylar ends up, you know, killing three people. So,
and they grew up in the same environment.
And they pretty much, well, yeah, Skylar was older and they had different mothers. But yeah, they grew up in the same environment, but the father was meaner to Skylar. And, you know, made Skylar stand in a corner and shove toothpicks under Skylar's nails for biting them, and told Skylar that that he was no good when he was a little boy. And when he was putting on dresses, he made fun of him and said, if you want to be a girl, I'll treat you like a girl, just like that. You know, just not good parenting from a, you know, federal con, ex-con, you know, drug trafficker who had guns and piles of cocaine everywhere, and Colombian, you know, drug lords hanging out at the house, that kind of thing. You know, fun
normal childhood.
Anyone, I'm sure.
You mean it's not? I mean, well, I didn't quite have the drug thing, but I'll tell you, my father was definitely that way, and I was the fourth child, and the older ones were all men, you know, and mechanics, right, and all this sort of stuff. And I was not. I was the thinker, and I wanted to do take music. I it was like, oh, we're going to make you into a man. And, you know, and the comments were stuff like, well, maybe I'll, you know, pee on you and you'll at least smell like a man.
Oh.
That was
oh,
where.
Oh, God.
So when I was listening to a lot of it, it was like, oh, wow, yeah, this is just, I remember this. But,
yeah,
like I said, I came out pretty happy. I'm pretty over it. I chose at a certain time to move on with life.
Mm-hmm. Right.
To go forward and live my life happy with what I have left and not hold on to that. Did you find that in cases like this and even others you come across that the childhood has a big effect, or is it just part of the symptom, or where do you place that yourself in the
when
whole?
When somebody asks me a question of what do you find in common between, you know, these stories where people turn into killers, what I often say is bad parenting. And that seems to me to be the most common thread. And you know, depending on, it doesn't even seem to matter what type of murder and how they carry it out, but the fact they are able to murder somebody else, it's, you know, I don't mean to be so flip about it, but I just mean that in every single case, and I can describe to you and analyze for you in each case what the parents did wrong, you know, and not, I'm not, you know, the parents maybe didn't know any better, and, you know, in some cases grew up in a horribly dysfunctional environment themselves, and it's not that they're, you know, bad people. It's, you know, sometimes tragic that they, and it's cyclical, you know, and that they learn bad habits and are brought up in a dysfunctional environment. And in some cases, they're, you know, born into this because there's mental illness or there's, you know, in this case, Skylar's case, Skylar's mother was using drugs while she was pregnant with Skylar. And continued to use drugs, and I believe also probably while she was breastfeeding, if she breastfed, she didn't sound like the kind of person who would breastfeed, probably did the bottles, but still, there's still going to be drugs in the milk, but regardless of all that, bad parenting, and in this case, even Skylar's father even said, wow, I thought I was bad, and, you know, Skylar turned out even worse than I did.
So. Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, I sort of put it to that. I your father, like mine, I don't think he wanted to be that way. It was just how he was created. You know, so it's just kind of you're right, it's cyclical. It's something they pick up. But, you know, anyway.
I just wanted to add one more thing.
Sure.
The other thing, which is a little bit of a sensitive topic, probably a controversial thing, but I've kind of come, after all these years of covering and following this case, I've been a professional writer and journalist. I don't want to date myself, but let's say 32 years. That's a long time.
You were 10.
Yeah, thank you. And an author for, you know, 15, 16 years of that. And so this case I've actually been following longer than any other case ever. I was in newspapers, and, you know, you don't stick with cases generally that long when you're in a newspaper story because you write it and you get out. But with these books, sometimes they take a while to get to court. But this one, I've come to kind of a different perspective over time, and learning about, not just about Skylar, but just about gender dysphoria in general, and reading up on some of these other inmates in other states that that helped contribute to the court precedents that got us to this point where in California now, transgender inmates are able to apply for taxpayer-subsidized gender confirmation surgery. And that's because these people are in jail, in prison, and they try to cut off their own genitals. They try to mutilate themselves, and this is after already, you know, killing somebody else and hurting other people. And so a lot of people don't feel sympathetic, but in fact, these people are really messed up, I mean, emotionally. And so, I mean, I don't think a lot of people want to think about this, but the fact of the matter is the reason that the court decisions came down is that they've really had to accept that gender dysphoria is a very it's a severe condition that causes extreme emotional distress. These people try to kill themselves. They try to mutilate themselves, and they, you know, can hurt other people too. But the reason that they end up getting these operations now, at least in California, not very many are approved, but they can get them, is because it's such a serious disease. And I, you know, in the courtroom, it's always, you know, these people are evil, and there's no room for any mental illness or any kind of other disorder that it comes out of a medical book, because, you know, this is all very controversial. People don't want to think about this. People certainly don't want their taxpayer dollars used for this. But it's the Constitution that these inmates must get, quote unquote, adequate medical care, and that's the heart of all this. But I've kind of come to look at it differently. Like, you know, part of the reason that Skylar DeLeon likely killed these people is, you know, partially at least, stemming from this disorder, gender dysphoria.
Well, I think it's interesting that you brought that up, because it is part of the motive, and maybe you could help the listeners by explaining a little bit about what the crime actually was and what their scheme was, because reading
right.
about it,
okay.
it's almost difficult to believe until you actually realize it's true.
And the reason that that I want to explain this, I want people, I'm just going to preface my comments with this. I am not being sympathetic to Skylar DeLeon. I don't want anyone to think that. Skylar killed three people. They were, by all accounts, super sweet, innocent, genuine, happy people. They were innocent. They didn't deserve this. I'm not in any way trying to excuse Skylar's behavior. I am just trying to explain it. So,
right. Tell us about the crime, because it does the motive
okay,
plays
yes,
a
okay.
pivotal role in that.
So Skylar, now this is a little bit tricky. I want to kind of get this out of the way. Skylar, during this whole case, was a he. Skylar had, you know, wanted to get this surgery, but was still identifying as a man. So it's kind of tricky in an interview like this, because as of a couple months ago, Skylar is now legally a she. So she's on hormones, living in a men's prison at San Quentin, but Skylar is now a she. So, and the proper journalistic approach to this is to call Skylar a she. So if I flip back and forth, it's difficult, because for the whole book that I wrote originally, because this is a reissue and there's 30 pages of new material because there have been all these breaking news developments and interesting changes at the state level in these prisons with regard to how they treat transgender inmates. But so if I go back and forth, that's just to kind of explain that it's kind of difficult as I'm telling the story. But so the crime, Skylar wanted to have this operation. Skylar was married to a woman named Jennifer Henderson DeLeon, and they had had one little girl together, and Jennifer was pregnant with a little boy, and Skylar and Jennifer were about $100,000 in debt because they were just these crazy spenders, and they didn't earn any money. Skylar didn't know what to do with himself at the time, because all he ever learned from his father was how to lie and cheat and to steal, essentially. Dad was moving around the whole time Skylar was growing up, so he didn't really get a good education. They were always trying to stay ahead of the cops. So all Skylar knew how to do was to steal money, and, you know, in this case, he planned. He'd already killed one person, which the detectives learned as they were in the middle of this investigation, that he'd already killed one person a year earlier, someone he'd met in jail while he was on a work furlough program, took the guy down to Mexico, slit his throat, left him by the side of the road to bleed out after taking $50,000 from him.
Mm-hmm.
So that, you know, he's capable of this. Jennifer knew that. He bought her a ring, and they paid off some debt. So here we are a year later. Skylar wants to get a boat and have some kind of charter business. And so he and Jennifer work out this whole scheme to get this boat, pretend to be buyers, take them out to sea on a sea trial to, you know, supposedly to test out the boat, take them down, handcuffs, tasers, make them sign power of attorney documents, tie them to the anchor, threw the anchor overboard with Tom and Jackie attached.
And they were alive.
They drowned, essentially. They were pulled to the bottom of the ocean floor. He took the boat out 35 to where it was, I think, 3,500 feet deep. And he had learned this by taking scuba diving lessons and basically told them, you know, if you sign these power of attorney documents, we'll let you live. But then they blindfolded him, gagged him, and then, you know, tied them to each other and then threw the anchor over and then they died. And it's, you know, the most heinous, most horrible imaginable way to die, honestly. I just think it was so brutal. And he had, you know, no remorse at all at the time, according to the witness who testified against Skyler and Jennifer.
And to get into that issue of how cold-blooded they were, can you tell us a little bit about the ruse they used with the child when they came to the boat?
So Skyler had come out to several times to meet with Tom and Jackie, and I guess early on, I guess kind of felt that they weren't really on board with trusting Skyler. Skyler said, "Well, I was a child actor. I made a bunch of money being on Mighty Morphin Power Rangers, and let them believe that he was one of the original Power Rangers, which he wasn't. He had two non-speaking roles because he couldn't remember any of his parts, any of his words, any of his lines. So basically, you know, and he didn't have any money. He was in debt. So basically, in order to gain their trust, he called Jennifer, and Jennifer's pregnant. She brought down their daughter in a stroller, and here she's pregnant. And he says, "Here's my wife," you know. And so Jennifer, you know, got into conversation with Jackie, and Jackie had a motorcycle accident with her first husband, and the motorcycle accident killed him and badly injured her to the point where she wasn't able to have children of her own. So, you know, they just basically used their trust to basically make them believe that they were people, you know, that they weren't. And
just a normal family.
Purchasing, yeah, that they were going to go live the American dream and charter out this boat, live on the boat. So and, you know, the ironic thing is that Tom was a retired probation officer.
Mm-hmm.
But the people that he had worked with were not killers. He had worked with the very small-time, you know, the small-time crooks. So I guess he didn't really know what he was dealing with. And the other thing about Skyler is, Skyler, I didn't even realize this till I saw Skyler on TV, but this was right before the sentencing. After the conviction and before the sentencing in 2009, Skyler went on TV, was interviewed by Dateline, 48 Hours, a bunch of different shows, and had this really high, effeminate voice. And what people said was they just had no idea that Skyler could be so dangerous because, you know, Skyler seemed so harmless and charming, you know.
Well, and that's really part of the most frightening aspect of this, where you're talking about the cold-blooded nature of them, tying them to the anchor and throwing them overboard. Right. I remember hearing about this story when it happened, but I kind of had forgotten about it. So preparing for this, I was, you know, I couldn't get that out of my head afterwards, after I had read that. And you actually interviewed Skyler. And I read something that you wrote.
Four times at the Santa Ana jail, you know, while Skyler was still presenting as a man, couldn't stop talking about wanting to cut off his own penis. And then I went and interviewed Skyler while she was now up in death row. And I was locked into a cage, in a visitor's cage with Skyler for 2.5 hours, and they took the handcuffs off her and locked us in together. And I was a little freaked out by that.
Why I wanted to ask you, because you had written in there that you said you were worried that the pen you were writing with or the spoon that she was eating with would end up in your throat. And usually when I hear somebody say something like that, it sounds kind of melodramatic. But with this situation, that person is... You don't know what that person's capable of.
Right.
They did the worst.
So basically, the way that it works is, you know, you go to visit somebody. I got in touch with Skyler through somebody else who's on the outside, who's also mentioned in the updated portion of the book, William Harder, who was a murderabilia dealer and was visiting Skyler and had some kind of bizarre sexual attraction to Skyler. I don't even want to go into the background of this person, but anyway, posted pictures of himself with Skyler on Facebook, and somebody pointed them out to me, and I couldn't even figure out where Skyler was in the picture because there was this woman in the picture with William Harder, and I said, oh my God, that's Skyler. I couldn't believe it because Skyler had her hair over in a side ponytail and was smiling and looked so happy and didn't really, really look anything like what she'd looked like before because previously she had been a bodybuilder and, you know, in good shape and looked like a man, you know, and now there's no beard and a little mascara and the side ponytail thing. You know, that's what threw me. I just couldn't figure out what I was looking at. I just went, oh my God, wow. So anyway, this guy said, well, you know, Skyler wants avocados, so bring enough money to buy Skyler food. So I'm like, okay. I mean, it was a little bizarre. So and they're not allowed to touch money. So before I went in, I went and bought the stuff because that was the agreement to go. Because, you know, you're meeting them during a lunch period. They don't get to eat. So, to be a good human being, you buy somebody food just like you buy somebody a cup of coffee. And anyway, so, but in the process, I had to bring in this plastic fork spoon called a spork so that Skyler could scoop out the avocado because otherwise, how do you get it out, right? To put it, I had to buy the quesadilla for the avocado to go on. And so I was worried about, I basically said, well, I'm not bringing in the plastic knife, that's for sure. I mean, I'm not that, you know, but maybe the spork, you know, would be harder to really get into my neck or into anywhere, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't mean to be blight about it, but this is literally what went on in my mind. And then we get on inside, and they had taken away my writing utensils. There's a whole bunch of rules when you go to prison. You're not allowed to wear an underwire bra. Because they're concerned that it's a weapon. They're going to take the iron, they're going to take the wire out of it, and somebody's going to use it as a shank. So I literally, when I went to go visit John Gardner, who raped and killed these two teenage girls here in San Diego County, Amber Dubois and Chelsea King, I saw the guards tell this 80-year-old, 70, 80, 90, I don't know how old she was, woman with a walker, to go into the bathroom and take her bra off. And she carried it back out, and they literally took it apart, and they took the wire out because it's, you know, it could be passed into to the prisoner, and the prisoner would then have a weapon. So they took away my pencil and my sheets of paper, which I was allowed to bring in, and they gave me a notebook and they gave me a pen. So I had this pen and a notepad rather in this locked cage with Skyler, and I was talking to her about her room, and she, you know, asked to use my pen to draw me like a diagram, and I'm like, I don't think I'm supposed to do that, so I tried to not hand her the pen because I'm picturing this, right? And then she goes, oh, no, it's okay, and I'm like, all right, because if you show any fear, it's like a, you know, it's like a dog.
Yeah.
You don't look a dog in the eye. You don't put your face close to a dog's face or you get bitten, which has happened to me, by the way, so I know. And so I was like, kind of casually handed my pen over, and I just kind of hoped and waited for the best, and she handed the pen back to me, and everything was fine. But it did go through my mind. I had another incident with John Gardner, the one I was just mentioning, who killed and raped and killed those two teenagers. I visited him in a lunchroom at Corcoran State Prison in a unit with Charles Manson. And I purposely visited on a Saturday because that was the day that Manson had visitors and just didn't have any visitors that day, so I didn't get to meet Charles Manson, who I later wrote a book about as well. But I was sitting across from John Gardner, and I had the same kind of fears that I would say something, and I'd seen him.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
React in court. You can say the smallest thing. They get angry. They reach across. And I just thought he could strangle me. And before the guard could get over there to save me, I could be, you know, in the clutches of this person who'd already killed two people. So when you go into these situations, you're a visitor. You're not an author or a press person. You know, the prisons are not approving your visit. It's the inmate who invites you. So there's not really any kind of precautions. And when I was covering prisons and jails when I worked for the newspaper, I literally had to sign a waiver because I was going for the newspaper, and I had to sign a waiver that said, I waive my rights, you know, if I get kidnapped or abducted or, you know, held hostage by the inmates, you know, I can't hold the prison accountable or whatever. I mean, literally, this is, you're taking your life into your hands when you go into these prisons as an author, as a journalist. But I just try to put that out of my mind and just do my job.
Well, you have to think about it. You'd be stupid not to be worried.
So the idea is you just don't purposely confront them or ask them questions that are going to cause them to shut down or to get angry at you. I mean, honestly, I just don't judge them. My questions are completely, I think them out in advance, and I've even taught this in classes. You know, you have to keep judgment. You have to keep any kind of opinions and bias out of your questions and make them as neutral as you possibly can and as non-confrontational as possible so that they think that they can, you know, they can open up a little more, you know. And they'll probably lie to you anyway, but at least, you know, you can write about that.
Yeah. Well, did you feel like he or she would try to manipulate you?
Oh, always. You know that. I mean, these people are all manipulators. Murderers are almost always huge. You know, that's why they call them con men, con women.
Mm-hmm.
So with Skylar, what was interesting is usually when I do an interview and somebody can't remember something, I'll give them a little nudge with a trigger of some kind, like a piece of information. Was it this? Was it that? Did you feel this or that? But with Skylar, I realized that she'd get this look on her face, this blank look. And I realized, you know, if I offered her any information, she would just take it and go with that. So it actually wasn't really helpful. She just told me whatever she thought I needed to hear or wanted to hear. Manson was the same way. That's what they do. They basically use whatever information you're giving them and kind of turn it around to give you what they think you want to hear, which is not what you want to hear. You want to hear what they have to say, but they're trying to please you, or they're trying to impress you, or they're trying to con you, or they're trying to, you know, make you believe that they're good people, you know, or they're victims. That's another thing they try to do. So.
Yeah, and that's part of the con, is to figure out the best way to get to you, what will influence you.
Right, and what was interesting about Skylar is there were times when she'd get this blank look, and what that meant was, I think, she couldn't figure out what I wanted to hear.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't like she could just answer the question. She didn't know how to answer some of these questions because I just don't know if she was capable of forming emotions for some of these questions. I, you know, there was like some sort of blank void in that part of her consciousness where she wasn't able to figure out what I wanted to hear, and she didn't know how to answer it because she didn't have any kind of way to formulate a thought in that way. It was kind of odd. I mean, that's different. She was different in that way than anyone else I've interviewed.
And she... I'm sorry, I'll go ahead.
I was just going to say, when you come to Skylar's pregnant wife, Jennifer, how did this affect their relationship? Like, what did Jennifer know and not know? And
right. Well, the interesting thing to me was, what was the dynamic between them? So whenever I have a case like this where you have a couple who are together committing a crime, somebody's got to be in charge. Somebody's got to be the mastermind, right? Now, what was interesting, you know, prosecutors can change their story with different juries, and they purposely severed these two so they had separate trials, which means that in each trial, the person who's on trial is the mastermind. It's the person who's dominant, right?
Yeah.
And so the jury doesn't know what the other jury was told. So when I, you know, comes to me writing a book, I just try to tell the truth, you know, and I report what was said in court and what the strategy was and what the prosecution's theory was that they presented. But at the same time, I want to know what really happened. And that's what I want to tell my readers, and that's what I do. So for me, one of the very first questions that at the heart of this story was, who came up with this, and how did they do it? And I think it's pretty clear that Jennifer knew what was going on. And even if she didn't know everything, she knew enough. And that's pretty much what the prosecution said as well, that, okay, where did the $50,000 come from a year ago earlier when this person was killed in Mexico? Where did Jennifer think the $50,000 came from, out of the blue, that she'd get a $10,000 diamond ring out of it when they were in so much debt? You know, she had to have known something was up, right? And then she was, the detectives, you know, have phone records that showed that every time Skylar did something, after, for example, taking Tom and Jackie and putting them in handcuffs and overtaking them and tying them up, and he went up and set the GPS for that place out where I said it was 3,500 feet deep, called Jennifer. So with each, and they could see, they did a lot of cross-checking, you know, forensically with this different technology, and they could, that's how they tracked out everything that happened. So there's mapping that they can do with the location of the cell towers that the signal's pinging off, and a certain time with the phone call, and then with the GPS being set, and they saw that he was checking in with her at every single point. You know, there were 15 times that he called her that day. And the year before, when he killed the other guy, there were 17 times that he called her, and that's more than he normally called her.
Yeah.
So they were able to show that they were talking. There was also, when they created the power of attorney documents on the computer, you know, there's a file that's created, there's a time when that file is created, and then there's a time when it's amended, and then there's a phone call that then correlates with that, and then there are changes to the file made, and, you know, so they, and it was a phone call between them, so they're talking the whole way through, and so he's reporting back to her, what, I just did this, you know. Obviously, we don't know exactly what they said, but, you know, it doesn't look so good in court, so we can assume that that's what was happening.
And they admitted their guilt.
No, I wouldn't say that. Jennifer never did. But with Skylar's case, he was up for the death penalty and Jennifer wasn't. So in order to try to save his client's life, Skylar's attorney made the decision to concede guilt in the guilt phase of the trial. So there's two phases to the trial. There's the guilt phase and then there's the death phase. So if the jury finds that the defendant is guilty, they then move to the death penalty phase of the trial to determine whether or not the defendant will get the death penalty. And so in order to try to present all this mitigating information about Skylar's abuse and childhood and horrible father and blah, 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 he felt that it was a smart tactical decision to concede guilt. Now, when I interviewed Skylar said, well, you know, that was Gary's decision, you know. Skylar says, well, I didn't actually, you know, he didn't really actually admit anything, and he didn't really kill the guy in Mexico. That was somebody else. And, you know, there's more information that I wasn't allowed to talk about, blah, blah, blah. So, yes, technically he conceded guilt, but it was the attorney.
Yeah.
So, and I said to Skylar, is there anything that you're going to want to say at the sentencing to this family of these people? You know, and I had to word it in such a way, as I said, to not be confrontational and, you know, not be judgmental, but try to at least get some kind of an answer. Do you feel bad about this? You know, and I get this kind of blank look. So there was no remorse there, and you know, and that's different from, say, John Gardner, who raped and killed these two teenagers. And he said to me when we sat down for an interview that lasted 5 hours, he said, you know, ground rule, I don't want to talk about what I did to these girls. I just don't think there's anything good that would come out of that. But he did cooperate, and so did his mother and family, to try, because he knew he should be in jail, in prison, knew that he'd probably kill again, and that he was where he belonged, and that he did admit to it, and for that reason didn't go to trial, didn't get the death penalty. So, you know, sometimes killers do have remorse, or at least have regret, and that's the whole distinction between, you know, do they really feel these things or not, or do they know right from wrong, and...
Or are they just upset they got caught?
Or are they upset they got caught, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think, you know, I think John Gardner really, you know, knew he did wrong. And we had a discussion about the word remorse, and I think it's a hard thing for these types of people to admit to, because I think they don't really know what it is for what it, you know. It seems that it's a hard thing for them to understand.
And they would have felt it before sometime, right? Long before your conversation, if they were really remorseful, they would have already gone through those feelings.
Right.
And I wanted to ask you real quick, excuse me for interrupting you, but you you were talking about how Skylar is kind of, I don't know, dodging responsibility, or at least not accepting responsibility for what happened. There were some accomplices involved in this.
Yeah.
And what happened to them?
Okay, so Alonzo McChain, this was a guard that he met in the Seal Beach jail, where he met the guy that he killed as well, who was in for counterfeiting. And the day that he went down to Mexico with this guy, who was already out, Skylar was still in, and he was supposed to be on a work furlough program. He made arrangements to go down to Mexico with this guy and his cousin, and, you know, cut his throat, left him by the side of the road, came back across the border, immediately called Jennifer. He and his cousin then go to California Pizza Kitchen to eat dinner and end up going back to the jail 2 hours late. Now, he called ahead to let Alonzo know he was going to be late, but he ended up showing up 2 hours late, and Alonzo never really did anything about it. He let him get away with this stuff. He basically was told by Skylar that, you know, he had all this family money and he was in real estate, he was going to help him get all this money, and so he got Alonzo to come along with him on this deal and said, well, these are bad people that we're going to kill. These are bad people. They're drug traffickers. You know, they've hurt other people. You know, we need to take care of them. So Alonzo came with him, bought handcuffs and tasers, and they go on there and they realize they're not big enough to overpower Tom Hawks, because Tom Hawks is a big, strong guy who's a bodybuilder. And so they bring a third guy, John F. Kennedy Jr., who is this 40-year-old Long Beach Insane Crips older gang member, right, who has a prison record of his own and is supposedly, you know, changed his ways and blah, 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 and is, you know, about to become a minister. And he gets recruited through another guy that Skylar knows, that he meets through a job that he got through Jennifer's father. So he's got people recruiting gang members for him to help be the muscle. And he's got Alonzo, who you know, trusts him. And so he brings these two guys on the boat and says, you know, this big, strapping black guy who's wearing a kind of a, you know, nice church Sunday clothes, this is my accountant. That's what he tells Tom. And Alonzo's just a friend who he's brought along before, and he's just a tall, skinny kid, you know, so he doesn't look threatening. And JFK is what they nicknamed John F. Kennedy Jr. His nickname was Crazy John, but they called him JFK because it was sort of a joke because he's obviously no way resembled the president, who we all know is JFK. But he had this long bearded braid. You know how the gang members have those long bearded braids? Like it's like a Fu Manchu kind of a thing that they braid down the... Anyway, he rolled it up and tucked it underneath so you couldn't tell. Because that's a sure sign that somebody looks like a gang member, right? So tucked it under and then looked respectable, right? So they show up, and that's how they overtook Tom and Jackie, separated them above and below, and then overtook them. And JFK was a pretty big guy, and he was, like, punching Tom and did it a couple times. So
wow.
That was it. Oh, and then there was, I mean, in terms of being accomplices, I mean, I would say those two are the main accomplices, but there were other people who got dragged into this and were scared to tell the truth because they thought Schuyler would kill them. There was a woman notary who notarized these papers that the boat sale had occurred and that she had seen it occur when, in fact, Tom and Jackie were already dead. And then there was the diving instructor who got the notary to do that, and he was the one who gave Schuyler the diving lessons and took him out to the spot where Schuyler ultimately dropped the anchor. So they were prosecution witnesses, but they didn't end up going to prison or anything. The notary lost her license, and the other guy basically just, I think, drank himself into oblivion. I saw him, and he had these purple circles under his eyes. He looked pretty beat.
So now, is he still... with his wife, so to speak, even though they're in...
Oh, no. Like... Jennifer divorced Schuyler almost right away after the trial because clearly her whole defense was, I didn't know. Her attorney said, she was scared. You know, when she did find out what was going on, it was too late, but it was after the fact, and she was scared to leave, and she didn't know the whole time. And then when she found out more that there was more to it, then... You know, it was after the fact, but and she's still claiming that today. She's in fact still claiming innocence. You know, Schuyler's a monster. I didn't know. I'm a victim. Blah blah blah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Do you think he was transgender before? Like he was.
Yeah.
He
when
was...
you're transgender, I mean, you're transgender. You.
Yeah.
I'm based on my knowledge of, you know, what Schuyler told me and what the other witnesses testified to in the courtroom, Schuyler was dressing up in dresses from when he was, you know, 5 years old. And I think that's generally when you a lot of people feel this. So basically Schuyler was struggling with this for a long time. But had to deal with dad and had to deal with a lot of this other stuff. But there was a long time where, she talked to me about this, that she was struggling with this and ended up going into the Marines thinking, well, maybe this will change my mindset, you know, because she just wasn't settled with it and, you know, didn't know was torn, you know. And so typically when you're transgender, you know pretty early on and then you struggle with it. And some people, you know, get settled with it early on and some people take quite a while to kind of deal with it. So, yes, I think Schuyler always kind of knew that and for many years told me that she had been wanting to get rid of her penis. It didn't feel like it was right with her body and who she was inside.
And I just wonder if her wife knew that too.
According to Schuyler, yes. But Schuyler had all kinds of stories. You know, Schuyler, after they started dating, had a motorcycle accident, and as part of the motorcycle accident, lost control of, I believe it was the bladder, and so had to wear adult diapers. So what he said was, you know, he told her that he needed to get this operation and wanted to get this operation, and as long as, you know, they had two kids already, she was okay with it. And he also told her that, you know, different stories, who knows whether he actually told her these things or not, but according to him, she told her that she had, you know, some kind of cancerous uterus or something that had to come out. And then there was the story that the incontinence problem would get solved as part of this operation. And that seems maybe, I don't know if that's true or not, if
yeah.
medically accurate, but yeah. it would seem like that would be a good believable thing, that if I were Jennifer, I would understand. I mean, who wants to wear an adult diaper, right?
Mm-hmm. And Skylar had needed $15,000 for that operation at the time of the murders. That was part of the plot to get that
yeah.
money.
Basically, Skylar had already found a doctor, and this doctor is a pretty well-known surgeon now, is also transgender, and had already had the operation herself, going from man to woman. And Marcy Bowers, I believe her name is, and she was originally in Colorado and then now has a practice. I believe she's still there in Burlingame, California. And this is, I talked with a transgender correctional officer at San Quentin who actually had the operation done by this very same doctor. So Skylar put down $500 deposit and needed $15,000 to actually have the surgery. And before you can have the surgery, there's a lot of stuff you're supposed to do. So you're supposed to be in therapy, you're supposed to be taking hormones, you're supposed to actually dress like a woman, you're supposed to present as a woman, I think for 2 years at least. And so Skylar wasn't doing that. So Skylar was pretty torn with all of this, you know, I think. And so it wasn't, Skylar's a messed up person, obviously.
Yeah, what a crazy story.
Yeah.
My word.
And the other thing is, you know, the prosecution did not really make this whole transgender surgery thing a big part of the case. In fact, it was almost not part of the case. The prosecution pretty much was saying it was just greed. Because,
yeah.
like I said, in the courtroom, these people are, killers are evil. Killers are not mentally ill, ever. They're evil. And that's it. It's just very black and white. And so, I always thought that it was kind of strange looking back that Skylar's attorney did not present any kind of mental health examination or any kind of results from that. And I asked why, and I was basically told we just didn't think it would help our case. I think because there were findings, you know, that would show probably that, you know, there was some kind of sociopathy there and, you know, lack of remorse and all kinds of other stuff. I asked Skylar, what are your diagnoses? And she came back with this list. This was when she was still at the jail. And I looked them all up, and they actually did seem to fit. And I came back the next week, and she said, oh, my therapist wanted me to tell you that the, you know, these are, you know, she read me some slightly different ones, and I'm like, okay, well, they fit, though, because I went and checked them out, and they're listed in my book. I can't remember them all, but there, you know, there were a number of them. So,
wow.
And, you know, she also was epileptic when she was growing up, and so a number of issues.
Yeah. Well, great book and great story, I'll tell you. Do you have a website for people to find you or anything like that?
Yes, I do. It's CaitlinRother.com, you know, https://www.CaitlinRother.com. And I have a blog as well on the website, lots of other fun stuff to look at, lots of photos. I'm on Facebook, I'm on Twitter, I'm on Instagram.
All over the world. Okay, great.
I'm everywhere.
We'll have that linked up, actually, on our website so people listening
okay,
can do one click and pick up the book and go to the website.
Awesome.
Wow. Great, great story and great work. And the book is called Dead Reckoning, and our guest and author is Caitlin Rother. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me on. Appreciate it.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.